I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. Here in L.A., we love to gripe about how bad the smog is. In fact, it's a national cliche. But if you're old enough to have taken a deep breath in Los Angeles back in, say, the 1970s, then you know just how bad air quality can get. Thanks to passing the strictest emissions regulations in the country, California now has relatively decent air. So the idea of rolling back on tough regulations for diesel trucks, well, to environmentalists at least, that seems to set a bad precedent. But truckers say they need more time to retrofit their rigs and to update to cleaner models. In response, the California Air Resources Board has proposed relaxing rules for aging diesel rigs. The board is expected to decide this on Thursday. Joe Rakovats is the Director of Governmental Affairs for the California Construction Trucking Association, and welcome to you.
Well, good to be here, Barbara.
So first, what are truckers asking for? What regulations do you want the Air Resources Board to ease up on?
Well, I think the first thing people ought to know is there's not just one ubiquitous feeling within the trucking industry. The industry is very divided on this issue, and even within our membership, divides have occurred. But what is going on Thursday, and this is a direct result of our political efforts within the state, is proposed amendments to the statewide truck and bus rule that essentially would have outlawed many of our members' trucks from the highways of California without either being retrofitted or replaced, that would relax temporarily the standards up front, allow them to operate their trucks for a period of time, about three and a half years, actually, and then at that point accelerate a demand that they move to a truck with an EPA-compliant O10 or newer engine. The rule as it stands right now would require them to move to that sort of engine by 2023. It would move that date up to 2018 and allow many, many small business truckers and owner-operators in California, and nationally for that matter, to continue operating their truck if they were denied a loan to replace their truck or retrofit it.
Okay, so they want some more time.
And yes.
Why, and as you say, some truckers want some more time. Why do they need more time to comply? And I know you've got your own rig. Is it so prohibitively expensive?
I don't truck anymore myself. I did truck for nearly 30 years. And our members, we are a construction trucking-based association, and our members predominantly are engaged in construction trucking. And the construction economy in California has not recovered. So we have many members still mired in the Great Recession. And no matter what, they couldn't comply. Now we do have members who have complied, most certainly. And that is part of the divide even within the industry. But when you compare housing starts in California in 2007, before the collapse happened, there were over 200,000 permits, building permits issued statewide. This year we'll be lucky to hit 50,000, and that just shows you that many of our members, no matter what their good intentions are, the economics is playing against them.
So a recession story here.
Yes.
Diane Bailey joins us now. She's senior scientist with the National Resources Defense Council, and it's good to have you on the show.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
So how would this proposed rollback on emissions regulations affect air quality in the state?
Well, diesel trucks and buses are the single largest source of toxic diesel pollution in the state. And this measure, the state clean truck and bus regulation, is really the biggest step to clean up this air pollution and protect public health. It's really a pillar of public health and a cornerstone of the state's efforts to meet federal air quality standards. Diesel soot has tremendous health impacts. It's associated with a range of respiratory and cardiovascular illnesses, such as asthma, heart attacks, strokes, diminished lifespan, adverse birth outcomes, more frequent emergency room visits, and even things like developmental delays and cognitive impairments from the various toxic constituents in diesel pollution. Now, when you look at areas of the state that have elevated levels of diesel pollution, areas around freeways and freight centers and urban centers, we see asthma rates that are double the state average. And that's a huge concern for us. But the good thing is that we have the technology to clean up this diesel pollution, and so many trucks have done so already by installing diesel particulate filters or upgrading to newer models, and we've seen tremendous progress on that front.
Well, we are talking about slowing down progress if these proposed changes went through, right, on reducing the particulate contaminants, not rolling back to previous levels, but slowing the rate of improvement of air quality, right? So how do you
Right.
calculate the health impact of that?
Right, and we're very concerned about that. Any move to delay the progress towards cleaner air is a concern to us. Now, this regulation, when complete, when fully implemented, is set to avoid 3,500 premature deaths and thousands upon thousands of cases of asthma and other health impacts. So the health benefits of the regulation are tremendous. Now, Air Resources Board staff tell us that they've crafted these amendments so that they preserve more than 90% of the emission reductions, and the emission reductions that they're losing, the 7% that they're losing, are primarily in rural areas, so they have made a great effort to minimize the loss of the health benefits in the latest amendments that they're proposing.
Joe Rakovats with the California Construction Trucking Association, I want to give you a chance to respond to that. What do you think of the science?
We think the science is pretty much bogus, quite frankly. The linkage between people living close to commercial enterprises and freeways and poor health outcomes, is, you know, there's an assumption here that it's directly related to diesel exhaust as opposed to poverty. Everybody knows that there are neighborhoods that more well-to-do people simply won't live in. We do have a study that we put in CARB's docket that it was a NIOSH study on truck driver mortality. And when you think about it in terms of what would be the proverbial canaries in the mineshaft if diesel exhaust was killing people at accelerated numbers, it would be truck drivers.
Are you disputing, though, the fairness of saying that deregulation is a sacrifice?
That deregulation is a sacrifice?
Yeah, to the improvement of air quality that we are rolling back. I mean, you give us that?
Well, you can call it rolling back. There are exemptions, extensions within the current rule. Would this allow an exemption extension for certainly more trucks? Yes, but as I said, it also on the other side, brings forward by 5 years the requirement to move to O10 engine technology. That accelerates on the backside of this by 5 years the environmental gains.
Diane Bailey, just briefly, I'd like you to respond to that. And really, we're talking about compromise here. So how does this fall in the realm of compromise, these proposals?
Right. And we understand that it's a struggle for some truck owners to comply with these regulations. At the same time, thousands of California families are sick and see their lifespans shortened due to this pollution. And in terms of the linkages between diesel soot and air pollution and the tremendous array of health impacts that we see, there are dozens of epidemiological studies across the U.S. and worldwide that have proven these links. In fact, the World Health Organization recently released a new count of 7 million premature deaths. Premature mortality, 7 million worldwide associated with air pollution. This is serious stuff, and dozens of the world's foremost experts have come together to tally these numbers. Here in California, we have about a couple thousand people dying prematurely due to diesel soot and other air pollution. So it's a very serious situation.
Well, let's bring in another view here. Dr. Wayne Miller is the manager of the Emission and Fuel Laboratory at UC Riverside's College of Engineering Center for Environmental Research and Technology. And that is a mouthful. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, could you give us some context here? I know that you've lived in the Pasadena area for the past 30 years. Remind us just how significant these regulations have been in cleaning up California's air since they were put into place in 2008. And how is our air now? How does it rate?
Well, our air, of course, is a lot cleaner than when I moved to Pasadena. I don't live there now in 68 when you couldn't see the mountains. But as way of background, I've had about 30 years going back to looking at vehicle controls from before there was a catalyst on an automobile because we take that commonplace. And then I spent 12 years, you know, at the university here looking at controls and mitigation techniques. And, you know, it's always a contested issue. It's, these things are not so simple in terms of whether the science is right or the technology is right. But it's clearly the case. I've watched diesel emission controls from the 80s when we couldn't really control them and to where we are today. And everyone would agree that the current filtering system removes particles and is actually practical and will work. I think what Joe's raising is the issue about the economics, and which is a very different context and dimension, because when they did the report for the 2008 regulation, perhaps the regulation looked at economics and growth that was different than we're seeing today, for example. But that doesn't change two perspectives. One is the filters work. And the second thing, I would take a little bit of an issue with Diane on the pillar. And CARB has not relaxed the pillar at all in the focus on 85% diesel PM reduction by 2020. And that doesn't apply, that applies not only to trucks, but to ships, to every place that there's a diesel engine, backup generators. And they've been systematically and comprehensively, addressing all of the diesel emissions. And it's clear, I'll take a little bit of difference here with Joe, that diesel is a toxic, and both recognized legally in California that way since, 1998, and also as of 2 years ago by the International Health Association. So diesel is a problem. The path to removing particles is through filters. They work. Whether they're affordable in the economics, I'll leave that to someone else to debate.
Well, so where does that leave you on these proposed changes to the regulation of diesel?
This is clearly a policy decision, and, the science, I think, as to where they work is clear. The economic fairness, I think, was addressed in the policy and staff reports, and so we'll see what happens on Thursday.
Diane Bailey with the NRDC, how important is the symbolism of holding the line in this debate? What place does it have in this issue of not setting the precedent of backtracking on air pollution progress in the state?
Well, we want to recognize that we have had tremendous progress in improving air quality and reducing diesel pollution over the past decade. And we want the state to stay on course and preserve the basic truck regulation. We understand that they're trying to add some flexibility and really minimize any reduction to health benefits. And I think they've done a good job trying to sort of tailor these changes and minimize that loss of benefits. We don't want to see any further loss in emission reductions. We want to see the remaining trucks in the state clean up. In fact, I'll note that about 85% of California registered trucks, according to ARB staff, are in complying fleets. They are working to clean up. And the California Trucking Association is actually opposed to these delays. They think that it's feasible to clean up, and they would like to stay the course on the regulation.
And Joe, just briefly in the last 30 seconds, why is CARB doing this? They have such a tough reputation. Why aren't they just telling truckers to get with the program or get fined? And this is the California Air Resources Board.
Yeah, well, part of it's the phantom emissions, is that with the economy having been reduced so much, there's a huge reduction in emissions just related to that. In terms of what the California Trucking Association, their opposition, you've got to remember that their member companies garnered hundreds of millions of dollars in public grants from all of us as taxpayers to replace their trucks. The smallest of the small, the most vulnerable truckers have been mostly shut out of that public grant process.
Gotcha. Joe Rakovats is a long-haul trucker, director of governmental affairs with the California Construction Trucking Association. Also with us today was Diane Bailey, senior scientist with the NRDC, and Wayne Miller of UC Riverside. And thank you to all of you.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
In a moment, are you eating in tonight? That's good, because after you hear our next guest, you're going to want to go out tomorrow and the next day and the day after that. The best 75 restaurants in L.A., a definitive list. That's next on Which Way L.A.?
Subscribe to the Which Way LA podcast at kcrw.com/whichwayla or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find Which Way LA on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
I'm Barbara Bogavin for Warren Olney, and this is Which Way LA. Orasawa. It's one of the most expensive restaurants in the United States, but it didn't make Los Angeles Magazine's new list of the 75 best restaurants in the city. And there are likely to be more surprises when the magazine releases the list tomorrow. You're sure to find some of your favorites in there. I know I did. And hopefully discover some places for artisanal toast or pork belly that you've overlooked. And of course, all of us foodies will find something to argue bitterly about. The list was edited by LA Mag's dining editor, Leslie Barger-Suter, and she's here now. Welcome.
Hi.
Okay, before we get to naming names, can you give us an idea what your criteria were? What qualifies a restaurant for this list?
Sure. You know, and I want to preface by saying we did this list the last time 7 years ago, and our criteria then was very different from now. I think 7 years ago, if you had a really nice meal, that was going to put you on the list. Now, you know, the competition has gotten so stiff that beyond just having great food and being a nice dining room, we really sought out restaurants that contribute something larger to the overall conversation about food in LA.
What does that mean? Like, they have to advance food culture in some way?
Yeah, they have to advance food culture. Hopefully they advance Los Angeles culture at the same time. You know, they need to stand for something. Is it, you know, using wood fire? Are you showcasing local ingredients? Are you showcasing new techniques? Are you bringing up the ideas of sustainability? You know, I think the restaurants that are on here really do more than just provide a delicious meal and a great dining experience. They also are really thinking big picture about food today.
Okay, let's get to it. Which old guard restaurants made the list? I'm curious.
Sure. So it's not all new and flash. Old guard, you know, we have Valentino on here, which is celebrating, I think it's 40 years. It opened in 1972 right now. So that's in Santa Monica, the Italian place. It's still here. It's still has relevance.
Why?
You know, it reminds us of the importance of details. There is something to be said for the places that keep up with classic dining from a service standpoint in a way that still really hits your sweet spot. You know, there's something about having a proper maitre d', about, you know, the way they know to bring the espresso 2 seconds after dessert and not right before. And there's details like that that really do, I think, keep some of the classic places relevant.
And we should say, you've gone to all of these places and also along with Patrick Q, your food critic.
So actually, yeah, Patrick Q was the primary critic for this package. He's the restaurant critic for Los Angeles Magazine. But, you know, to find 75 best, you need to go to 300. So we had to split it up, the eating, over several months with a few different people, myself included. So we do go back to every single restaurant and make sure that the places deserve to have a spot on the list.
Oh, poor you. How about the dives?
You know,
there's always a place for a good dive.
You know, we do. There, absolutely. Now, the dives, we have a Cheap Eats issue we put out every single year where we do a bit more of sort of your mom and pop diners. But we do have some places that are kind of unexpected, especially actually kind of high up on the list. For instance, a place called Night Market, which is in West Hollywood. They are sort of an informal Thai canteen. He specializes in really bold flavors of North Thailand, sort of the Chiang Rai and Chiang Mai regions. But the food, the place is very, there's no trappings. This is kind of white walls, a few little bits of weird esoteric art, loud music.
It's very loud.
You've been.
They specialize in loud.
You go on a Friday night, it's not just the music that's loud, it's extra loud. I think loud shows up on your plate as a side dish. So but that place is very much informal. There's another restaurant on the list called Squirrel that is in the larger Silver Lake area, which also appears pretty high up on the list. You'd be surprised. And that's another place that really, you know, there's barely even seats. They kind of just added an actual dining area and counter, but it's an order at the counter kind of place. But the food there is really pushing cuisine in the city.
And that comes under the heading of artisanal, right? And also locally sourced, organically sourced. And is that a theme that you noticed?
All of those buzzwords are happening this year. Yes, artisanal, you know, locally sourced. The word local appears on every menu. You're going to see where each item comes from. Every item has a brand name. They're not just carrots. They're Wiser carrots. they're not just chicken. It's Jidori chicken. And I think that's something where, again, 7 years ago, I think you probably would have just gotten a chicken. And nowadays, that is certainly not the case.
Well, can't you get not make the list because you take that to such an extreme?
Sure. You know, there are restaurants that can be a little overly precious about it. Most of the restaurants that tend to do that well, we like to reward because they tend to do it well. But there are some restaurants that ended up that do, you know, cite that as their ethos that maybe aren't as high up on the list as they wish they were.
Well, what was a really tough one to kick off the list?
Oh, gosh. We had a lot that we battled over. Lots and lots and lots. So Wolfgang Puck's Cut is a restaurant that is certainly a wonderful steakhouse. In terms of getting a really, really fine cut of meat, it still ranks up there among one of the more relevant steakhouses in the country. But at the same time, a steakhouse in itself, we were having trouble coming up with the relevance for. You know, sticking with our argument that what does this contribute to the larger conversation about food, while it's delicious, we couldn't really find a reason to keep it on.
Well, look, I know you can't tell me who won. My producer told me that, but I feel like doing charades, you know, one word, three syllables, sounds like. Can you even give a category to the...
Yeah, well, I think it's going to be a surprise to people. The restaurant that's number one is not necessarily new. It is not necessarily flashy. It is probably more comfortable than you would expect, which I think is why we put it on the list. It is, in our point of view, this is really the pinnacle of a great LA restaurant. It has an immense sense of place. You could be in no other city in the world and eating this kind of food and in this kind of environment that it blends inside and outside, and you can eat, you know, very casually and sort of small, and then you can also eat big. It's a little something for everyone.
Nobu Cafe Pinot. Like, no one's listening. You can just whisper it in my ear.
As long as nobody's there. No, it's not that fancy of a spot. It's comfortable and inviting and familiar. And I think, but in that way, is so LA.
Okay, other trends, mixologists.
Yeah, oh,
handlebar
man.
Mustaches and barbershop quartet.
Yep, and vests and the whole deal. Yeah, the bar made its big debut on this list. I don't know the exact percentage, but most of these restaurants, if they are able to have a cocktail program due to licensing, they make that a big part of the food. It's not just that you can sit down and have a martini before you eat, or maybe a dessert cocktail afterwards. You know, there are cocktail pairings and, you know, artisanal syrups that are whipped into the various concoctions, and I think that the restaurants as a whole really sought to make the bar program incorporate it more into the overall feel of the restaurant.
And who's a winner in that category?
There's a ton. Actually, the restaurant that's number one, which I still can't tell you, actually is really, really known for incredible cocktails.
Well, that's a clue.
It's true, absolutely. You know, Baco Mercat, and that's one of Joseph Centeno's restaurants. He always has really, really incredible cocktails. You know, Melisse actually now has its own cocktail program, which is actually really, really high-end and modern, like as you would expect from a restaurant like Melisse.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, I'm thinking that this whole speakeasy trend might be jumping the shark, though. You know, I mean, how many times can you, you know, find the secret door or push aside the shelves of books?
You know, you say that in the very month that just a few days ago a restaurant or a new bar opened where you have to go through
the garage
and open a refrigerator to go into this sort of like 70s garage themed cocktail bar. So I think it's not quite done, and people still get a bit of a hoot out of it. But I do think that the sort of throwback cocktails, that culture, just looking to the past for inspiration for drinks is kind of dying out. And now I think chefs and bartenders or mixologists are collaborating together to come up with really modern ways to make drinks using really great ingredients and flavors and, you know, infusing their own syrups and that kind of thing that are actually pushing the cocktail culture into the modern day.
Well, just the last trend, because it's my favorite, molecular gastronomy.
Yeah, I mean,
who ranks high? You know, who does the best freeze-dried, then rehydrated sea urchin mousseline?
Yeah, you know, the place that does it best is one that, you know, is one of the few places that does it in a way that still feels relevant, which is Ink. Michael Voltaggio, he opened that a few years ago, and there was a lot of buzz, and there's a lot of, you know, deconstructed this and powder that. But and that on its own as a trend is actually kind of passé. It's on its way out. But what Michael has done that's so great is he actually incorporated the techniques that actually work, that aren't just gimmick, that actually taste good or enhance the food, and he uses those. And so he kind of has whittled down that what was kind of an overblown trend and now just incorporates ingredients. It's kind of just into his chef repertoire. It's like a good sauce, you know, but it happens to be liquid nitrogen or some sort of chard.
And just really quickly, to end fittingly, the best restaurant to go to for dessert.
Oh, God, there's so many. You know, I'm a huge fan of Cook's County. Roxana Julepat is the pastry chef there, and she just does beautiful things. They're a little bit sort of playful interpretations of classics. She has an apricot creamsicle dessert that's sort of reminiscent of creamsicle. She does a rhubarb linzer torte that's just a must. It's those desserts, they're seasonal. They change all the time, and as someone with a huge sweet tooth, it's one of my favorite places to go.
I'm right there with you. Leslie Barger-Suter is the dining editor for Los Angeles Magazine, and their list of the 75 best restaurants in L.A. comes out tomorrow. Thanks so much. That was so much fun.
Thank you.
Remember, you can always join the conversation on our Which Way L.A. Facebook page.